Hi, welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today I'd like to share with you some of the presentations that were held at the American College of Cardiology, held 15th through the 17th of May 2021, virtually, of course, this year. One of the talks at ACC21 this year that got some attention was a new analysis of the Voyager PAD trial. And this was a talk held by Dr. Rupert Bauersachs. He's the director of vascular medicine at Darmstadt Clinic in Germany. And he was the lead author of this particular study. He described the use of rivaroxaban and how it reduced the occurrence of severe events of the heart, limb, or brain issues related to other vascular complications in patients with symptomatic peripheral arterial disease, PAD, who underwent lower extremity revascularization. And the findings really underscore the broad benefits of the strategy in looking at this very high-risk patient population. Recent data have shown that lower extremity revascularization holds a fourfold risk of acute limb ischemia afterwards, and of course this is associated with the high incidence of limb-related complications. So the randomized double-blind Voyager PAD trial enrolled 6,564 patients in 34 countries who had peripheral artery disease and had undergone lower extremity revascularization. The patient's median age was 67 years old, and 74% were male. Patients were randomly assigned to either receive rivaroxaban or placebo in addition to daily aspirin, and the trial's primary endpoint was timed to the first event of a composite of acute limb ischemia, major amputation of vascular etiology, myocardial infarction, ischemic stroke, or cardiovascular death. Another pre-specified endpoint was the total number of vascular events, including recurrent primary endpoint events, as well as other vascular events. The median follow-up time was 28 months after revascularization. The research team reported a late-breaking clinical trial presented at the ACC20 last year that Voyager PAD had met its primary endpoint with a 15% statistically significant reduction in the risk of a first major adverse limb or cardiovascular event seen in patients who had received rivaroxaban compared with those who had received the placebo. The current study reported on the total number of vascular events, with over 4,700 occurring in the 6,564 patients who were randomized over 3 years, meaning that approximately one-third of the patients experienced at least one vascular event. So one limitation of the study is that the trial was designed to assess the occurrence of the first adverse events following lower extremity revascularization, but in the double-blinded trial, patients may come off study treatment or go on to other therapies after an event, which can attenuate the observed benefit. Assessment of the total number of adverse events, however, was a pre-specified secondary endpoint, and despite this limitation, the findings were statistically significant and really robust in absolute terms. So the take-home message from this follow-up data was really that the Voyager PAD really looked beyond the first event and found that subsequent thrombotic events were reduced with rivaroxaban in addition to aspirin, so it really underscored the importance of long-term prevention in these high-risk patients. Next, I'd like to talk about a talk held by Dr. Bruce Shelter from the Piedmont Heart Institute in Georgia, the United States. And Dr. Shelter talked about etripamil. And that is a novel L-type calcium channel blocker. And it's in a phase 3 NODE 301 trial looking at the efficacy and safety of etripamil in its ability to effectively and safely terminate symptoms of supraventricular tachycardia. So participants with a history of ECG-documented PSVT were randomized in a 2-to-1 fashion to self-administer either etripamil, and there were 107 patients in that group, or placebo, and there were 49 patients in that group, during an episode of the PSVT. So NODE 301 trial failed to meet its primary endpoint, which was a pre-specified efficacy analysis of superiority of a single 70 milligram dose of etripamil over placebo for a conversion of an episode of PVST over 5 hours. And there was a hazard ratio of just over 1, but it was not significant. A post-hoc secondary analysis, however, presented here, demonstrated a clinically meaningful treatment effect achieved with etripamil as compared to the placebo with a hazard ratio of 1.7 and a significant p-value. And happily, etripamil had an acceptable and favorable safety profile. So at the ACC meeting in 2021, Dr. Shelter discussed the secondary clinical endpoints of the NODE 301 trial, and these were namely, one, the relief of specific symptoms, such as heart palpitations, rapid pulse, chest pain, anxiety, shortness of breath, dizziness, and fainting. patient-reported satisfaction as measured by the treatment satisfaction questionnaire for medication, the need for any emergency interventions, the need for any additional rescue medication therapy. The study population had a mean age of 55 years old and had a high burden and frequency of PSVT episodes over the past year, ranging from 7.4 episodes in the etripamil group to 11.3 episodes in the placebo group. Etripamil was more effective than placebo at relieving PVST-specific symptoms, and the TSQM-9 score, so that was a patient-related outcome, for global satisfaction with treatment and treatment effectiveness were both significantly higher in the etripamil group than in the placebo group. During the 5-hour observation period which followed administration of etripamil, 28 participants sought additional rescue medication intervention, and 25 of these presented to the emergency room, and 5 self-administered oral rescue medications for PSVT. In the etripamil group, 14% of respondents sought additional medical therapy as compared with 26.5% in the placebo group. Most commonly, this consisted of intravenous adenosine administered in the emergency room. The time to emergency room intervention was longer in the etripamil group than in the placebo group, at 116 minutes versus 79 minutes, and that was a significant number, suggesting that those in the etripamil group waited longer to seek additional emergency therapy than those in the placebo group, again favoring the etripamil arm of this trial. So the researchers concluded that further development and promotion of etripamil nasal spray for the treatment of PSVT, it's really supported by these favorable data. So now we're going to move on to COVID-19, and there's been a question lingering in the community about whether therapeutic anticoagulation is equally effective, clinically speaking, to prophylactic anticoagulation for patients with COVID-19. And we know that patients with COVID-19 experience frequent venous and arterial thromboembolisms, and elevated levels of D-dimer, a thrombotic biomarker, are harbingers of poor clinical outcomes, including disease progression and mortality. Data regarding the type, dosage, and duration of anticoagulation strategy is actually really needed. So Professor Renato Lopez from Duke University Medical Center in the United States presented the ACTION Coalition trial, which was designed to investigate the effectiveness of a full anticoagulation strategy as compared with a prophylactic anticoagulation strategy in patients who had been hospitalized for COVID-19 and had elevated levels of D-dimer. Group of 311 patients received a 30-day course of rivaroxaban at 20 milligrams once daily, and the comparison group of 304 patients received the standard in-hospital prophylactic venous thromboembolism protocol. The primary outcome was the hierarchical analysis of mortality, length of hospital stay, and duration of oxygen therapy over the 30-day intervention period. Results were analyzed using an unmatched win ratio method and stratified by clinical severity. Major bleeds occurred in 10 of the 310 patients in the rivaroxaban group, which is 3.2%, as compared with 1.3% of patients in the prophylactic group. In terms of all-cause mortality, 35 out of 310 patients, 11.3%, in the rivaroxaban group died, as compared with 23 out of 304 patients in the prophylactic anticoagulation group, which is 7.6%. And that provided a relative risk ratio of 1.49 in favor for the prophylactic treatment with anticoagulation in patients with COVID-19. I also wanted to touch on the RAFT-AF trial. So this was a trial presented by Professor Anthony Tang from the University of Ottawa in Canada, who shared the results of the RAFT-AF trial. This was a trial that looked at how to maintain sinus rhythm in patients with both heart failure and atrial fibrillation, and using an ablation-based rhythm control. And they looked at the number of all-cause mortality and heart failure events, and they compared that with the rate control. The background and justification for the study stems from the fact that maintaining sinus rhythm in patients with both heart failure and atrial fibrillation using antiarrhythmic drugs does not really confer any survival benefit as compared with allowing the patient to continue in atrial fibrillation medicines. While catheter ablation offers an alternative to achieving rhythm control and resolving atrial fibrillation, there have been no long-term studies examining its effect on the outcomes of mortality and admissions for heart failure. To address this clinical gap, the RAFT AF trial atrial fibrillation used a prospective randomized open blinded endpoint probe design to compare catheter ablation-based atrial fibrillation rhythm control with rate control in patients who had been diagnosed with both heart failure, defined as either an impaired left ventricular ejection fraction or less than or equal to 45%, or a preserved ejection fraction of greater than 45%, as well as atrial fibrillation, and that was using a composite endpoint of all-cause mortality and heart failure events. A heart failure event was defined as admission to a healthcare facility for more than 24 hours, a significant worsening of heart failure requiring intervention, or receiving a previously unplanned intravenous diuretic and increased therapy for chronic heart failure. So like I mentioned before, Professor Tang presented these results, and researchers randomized 411 patients with both heart failure and atrial fibrillation to receive either ablation-based atrial fibrillation rhythm control, and there were 214 patients in that arm, or rate control, and there was 197 patients in that arm. The primary outcome was a composite of death and heart failure events, and the median follow-up period was 37.4 months. Among the 197 patients in the rate control group, 32.5% had reached the primary outcome, as compared with 23.4% of the ablation-based rhythm control. Although there were numerically fewer events in the ablation group, the difference was not statistically significant, with a hazard ratio of 0.71 looking very favorable, but not quite significant. So secondary outcomes included the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure Questionnaire and the atrial fibrillation effects on quality of life scores, and changes from baseline were both improved in both groups. But after adjusting for time and competing cause of death, there was a greater improvement in the rhythm control group than in the rate control group. All secondary outcome measures consistently showed the greatest improvement in the subgroup of patients with a lower ejection fraction of less than or equal to 45% in the rhythm control group. Adverse events occurred equally between the groups, and about half the patients in the group of the rate control group and 47.7% in the rhythm control group experiencing a serious adverse event. So the researchers concluded from this trial that while their results demonstrated no statistically significant effect of ablation-based rhythm control over rate-based control in patients with atrial fibrillation and heart failure as a whole, there did appear to be some clinical benefit in the reduced ejection fraction group of 45% or under.
Professor Hyo-Soo Kim from the Seoul National University Hospital in South Korea presented the data from the HOST exam study, which looked at monotherapy clopidogrel versus monotherapy with aspirin in patients who had experienced an event-free 6 to 12 months following percutaneous coronary intervention, PCI, using a drug-eluting stent, DES, over a two-year follow-up period. So in patients who have experienced an acute myocardial infarction and undergone PCI, guidelines suggest 6 to 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy, typically aspirin plus a P2Y12 inhibitor such as clopidogrel. After the initial 6 to 12 month period, lifetime monotherapy is recommended, and although guidelines do not specify which type of monotherapy, aspirin is the most widely used. So Professor Kim and his colleagues aimed to explore whether an alternative monotherapy could achieve superior clinical outcomes when compared to aspirin. To address that question, the multicenter open-label HOST exam study randomized 5,438 patients who had completed 6 to 12 months of event-free dual antiplatelet therapy following myocardial infarction and PCI. 2,710, so 49.8% of participants, took clopidogrel only, and 2,728, so 50.2%, took aspirin only. And all participants were followed for 24 months. The primary endpoint was a composite of all-cause death, acute coronary syndrome, including non-fatal myocardial infarction, stroke, the need for revascularization while under antiplatelet therapy, and grade 3 or higher bleeding. At 2 years, 5.7% primary endpoint events had occurred in the clopidogrel group compared with 7.7% in the aspirin group, and that gave a hazard ratio of 0.73 in favor of clopidogrel and a p-value that was highly significant. The researchers acknowledged that some limitations of this trial were there. It was an open-label trial, and it was conducted in South Korea only, so therefore results may not be entirely generalizable. Furthermore, most of the enrolled patients had followed a DAPT regimen for about 1 year. Thus, results may not be generalizable to those who had been on DAPT for a shorter period of time either. Professor Robert Rosenson from the Icahn School of Medicine presented the results from the double-blind treatment period at the ACC 2021 scientific session of a small phase 2 study looking at evinacumab in the reduction of fasting triglyceride levels compared with placebo. The background to this study is that angiopoietin-like protein, ANGPTL3, helps regulate plasma lipid levels via the inhibition of lipoprotein lipase, LPL, and endothelial lipase-mediated hydrolysis of triglycerides and phospholipids, and a loss-of-function variant on the ANGPTL3 gene results in lower levels of blood triglycerides. Evinacumab is a fully human monoclonal antibody inhibitor of ANGPTL3. This phase 2 randomized placebo-controlled trial explored the feasibility of evinacumab and as a therapeutic option for severe hypertriglyceridemia. The trial assigned 51 patients to one of three different cohorts. Cohort 1 was 17 patients and comprised patients with familial chylomicronemia syndrome and loss-of-function mutations in the LPL pathways, whereas Cohort 2 had 15 patients and it had patients with multifactorial chylomicronemia syndrome in addition to LPL pathway mutations, and Cohort 3 were 19 patients and it comprised of patients with multifactorial chylomicronemia syndrome, but no known LPL pathway mutations. The treatment protocol consists of a 12-week double-blind treatment period followed by a 12-week single-blind treatment period. And so, like I said, it was the results from the double-blind treatment period that was just presented at this particular meeting. The primary endpoint was change in serum triglyceride levels at week 12 among participants in cohort 3. In this cohort at week 12, the least squares mean reduction in triglycerides was 27.1% with a pretty good and tight confidence interval. And the corresponding median reduction in triglycerides was 68.8%, an absolute median change of triglycerides of minus 905 milligrams per deciliter. Professor Rosenson noted that the response did vary across genotype and that further investigation is certainly warranted to better understand the differences. A phase 2b trial will be done to assess evinacumab's ability to prevent acute pancreatitis. Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers about the AAC 21. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. Stay safe and stay healthy.